are bathed in radio waves, TV broadcasts, probably telepathic messages, from other minds deep in thought.
Listening to the radio at the same time.
And this radio simply makes audible something that you thought was inaudible.
Hey, it's John Sturman from Ukuleles Unleashed. You're listening to WGXC Acra, Hudson, Catskill. 90.7 FM radio for open ears.
On Saturday, December 10th, the Athens Cultural Center puts on the 2022 Athens Victorian Stroll, a holiday tradition that's been gone for a few years because of the pandemic, but is back this year with all sorts of free activities from 1 p.m. in the afternoon through the evening. Take a stroll through the village, sample all sorts of food and drinks. Santa Claus will be around and carolers will be singing. That's at the 2022 Athens Victorian Stroll on Saturday, December 10th. Go to the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org for more information.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by SunCommon, supporting vibrant communities across New York for 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Marcus DeGrazia Acupuncture of Austerlitz, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. Become a WGXC sustaining supporter today. Go to wgxc.org and click donate. Thank you for your support.
Good evening. Thank you for joining. I am Kimberly Y. Irwin, your host of Race Talks on WGXC 90.7 FM, a wayfarm.org enterprise. WGXC 90.7 FM is a listener-supported, solar-powered, hands-on community media organization covering Troy to Poughkeepsie, Middleburg to Great Barrington. So if you're in one of those places, you're in for a treat today. And if you're not, you're listening via internet, and you are so lucky for technology. Here every third Tuesday of the month from just around 7 p.m. to 8 p.m. is where we have the very necessary conversation on race and ethnicity. Oftentimes I'm asked, why talk about race? And my answer is always to combat racism. But we just can't talk about it. We have to be about it. And although education is key, a discussion is a must. So we all need to take an active role in ending racial injustice here in America and abroad, because there's simply one race, the human one, and many ethnicities. So you'll find me here with my guests who come from every walk of life, every ethnic identity, and are very supportive of everyone, treating one of every ethnic identity as respectful as one can. So here on Race Talk with my guest is where we keep it real and no
taboo.
Okay, great job. So my guests in unison were for this November, two fabulous guests. They are Dr. Timothy L. Harper, an associate professor in the Management and Business Department at Skidmore College in New York. Dr. Harper has taught courses related to management, social identity, industry structure, and innovation for well over 20 years. His involvement with his community and social justice is hands-on and knows no bounds, having given of his time from those who are incarcerated to those who are entering the business arena. Like me, thank you so much. Establishing their brands, all pro bono. And joining us is attorney Summer Burnley, whom I just met at this amazing assembly that we may discuss if we have time. But she's the owner of Burnley Law PLLC, a virtual and boutique law firm that advocates for clients and their businesses through trademark law and strategic business consulting. Her work has helped entrepreneurs launch, manage, and scale high-end six- and seven-figure businesses. Attorney Burnley and African-American women of Native American descent and heritage has her mission to help ambitious modern women of color entrepreneurs, and does this through her practice as the host of the Lurk Lounge podcast, where she discusses the real and all things entrepreneurial, legal, and business without the fluff. So I know with my two guests, I can just sit back and really wait to just converse at the end. As you know, we have a variety of segments, Q&As, wows, which are our words of wisdom, and talk terms, which today's talk term is going to be code switching. And we may even talk a little bit about all the ways that Native American identity has changed within the United States. Also, firsts. There are lots of firsts for Native Americans. We will get into that. And of course, I'm going to end with White Axe, because there are many upcoming events that if you just attend, you will be showing that you care about Native American heritage and culture and your identity. Because without recognizing others' identities, how might we expect anyone to recognize and value ours? So, because I mentioned the bios of my guests, I don't want them to think that they get off scot-free. We're going to introduce the first segment on Native American Heritage Month in recognition of this fabulous month. So I want to introduce Summer Burnley initially, and then of course, we're going to get more into the business entrepreneurial side, where we discuss actual self-identification in the workplace. And so I'm going to then ask Dr. Harper to say a few words about who he is and about this topic. And then again, we're just going to weave and go in and out of many of the talk topics as they relate to our, or talk segments as they relate to our talk topics. Okay, so let me just mention a little bit first on Native American heritage. One of the reasons I am so thankful of having this show is to introduce to people who are still very much in the dark on what it means to identify as an ethnic group. Many people, especially of a larger group of people in any nation, they really do not have to look to see who's around them. Everyone has to be up on their culture. And that's kind of like being in America, where Americans are seen as one of the higher nations, first world nations. And so we basically don't need to know so much about other cultures and other countries or where they are on the globe or on the map. But when you look to Native Americans, our country is their country. They have come from nowhere. They've been here all along, and they've been here on the land, and where they had, you know, like to say, when they work hard, they, you know, they sweat and they bury their dead. They have centuries upon centuries of knowledge about everything that makes a land their home, and then to be taken away from it or to be moved around it without any permission. It's a real sad state. And of course, anybody who is in America who's not Native American, we can value what their tribes and communities have gone through, because this land is quite a wondrous land. And I think I can say for everyone who's here, we're so very thankful that we are here. And although we're not so supportive of the way we all became Americans on this great land, we certainly do know that we must value those who have come before us and who had made this land what it is today. And certainly the Native American population definitely needs our recognition for that. So I thought to say something on my own about it, but I read some really amazing materials that I would like to share with my audience. And then I will introduce Attorney Summer and find out, or should I say Attorney, I know her as Summer, but Attorney Burnley, what her thoughts are of it, being that she is of Native American heritage. And that's how we actually got to speaking about her being on the show. So let me just let her take a pause right now. So she's thinking about what she will be sharing with you while I read a little bit about this particular this text. And again, people go, I don't know anything about something. You can Google it. And all you have to do is know what is valuable to look at. And not everything is the same kind of material. So this comes from Native Americans Today, and it's about Native American education history. And I know from being of African American descent, we get so very little in our home public schools about our ethnicity, our heritage, our cultural heritage and understanding. Even on our months where we have recognition, very little is shared. And I keep it real here on Race Talks, and I can only really talk about what I know. And I don't see any real conversation starters in schools about Native American Heritage Month or in our industries, on our main streets, like zero, nothing. If I'm wrong, you know, call me out. And so I really want to share what they're facing. So I'm reading from the text of Native American Life Today. Native Americans today face some extraordinary challenges. By nearly every social, cultural, economical, and physical measure, Native American communities and families are uniquely and negatively impacted by patterns of struggle. While it is important to be positive and hopeful about the future of life for Native Americans in this country, it is first important to have a genuine understanding of what Indigenous people face collectively and individually. To understand what Native American life is like today, we first need to understand what it used to be like. For the past 500 years, Native Americans have faced genocide, dislocation, and various forms of physical, mental, and social abuse. These factors have led to high rates of violence, assault, suicide, poverty, and abuse among the Native American people today. And I think one of the reasons to share the downside of every cultural group when is to see how they rise, right? So I wanted to highlight that in the text that I just read. Now, there's many text on learning more about Native American history. And so I say that to say, if we're not force-fed it in school, doesn't mean that we should not learn from it. We can all Google information. We can go to our local library. We can probably even go to the school library. They may have the books there if they're not showcasing them out. So don't think that because it's not given to you that it's not important to have, right? So those are some of the issues. And I want to definitely recognize that the power of storytelling is healing, and the stories that Native Americans can share with us is definitely one of the things that I look most forward to when I look at a month like this. And of course, we shouldn't just celebrate the culture of Native Americans just in one month or one day. November 25th is actual Native American Heritage Day. So they actually have one day. So think about that on the day after Thanksgiving, when everyone's shopping. Maybe you could be shopping for a book to read about Native Americans if you don't already know. I want to also let you know that there's ways you can be allies of groups. Just attending some of their functions are a great way. And although I was going to share with you a powwow, actual audio of a powwow, my technological disadvantage right now doesn't allow me to do so. But I think everywhere you live in America, there's a possibility of a powwow near you, you know, within maybe a 50 to 100 mile radius. So check out whether or not that there are powwows that are open to people, and participate, or, you know, donate money to an organization that supports Native American learning and teaching and their activities. So if you can't go, you can certainly still partake by that way, by being an ally. So I'm going to end that and welcome Summer. Summer, can you introduce yourself to my guests about who you are and why you feel it was important for you to come on to talk about Native American Heritage Month and, you know, your business?
Yes. First of all, Kimberly, thank you so much for having me on Race Talk. I have been very much looking forward to having this conversation with you and Dr. Harper and the listeners. And, you know, I'll tell you, my Native American heritage is not something that I speak to others about much. So the hap stance that we had a chance to talk about, it was kind of just kismet.
Recording in progress.
There are conversations and stories that are had, of course, amongst family members. And I guess you could say we always joke, but seriously, but my father is what we would jokingly call the two percenter. So he's an only child, and he's the last male in our family who can legally claim his Native American heritage. And I shared some pictures with Kimberly of my father and my grandfather and, you know, my grandmother. And they all have very distinct Native American features, but the stories and the traditions of their tribes is long gone. And so it's difficult, you know, to wonder, especially growing up, when you're told some of these stories about your ancestry and who these people were and, you know, where you truly come from, and not really have a viable way to get or receive the information that is personal to you, you know, in a way that's not washed out. And so shedding light and just having conversation around, you know, what that means and what it looks like, even as a descendant of someone who's has Native American ancestry, was something I felt that was important to do and extend beyond, you know, the family kitchen table. So thank you for giving me the space.
Well, I'm so glad that you came on, because, you know, I jumped on it when you shared those pictures. And I was always taught, I guess, I don't know if taught would be a great word, but I, you know, I grew up thinking of choosing, you know, to make a choice between what's the better character, right? A Native, an Indian, as we grew up knowing the term, and for Native Americans, or like, well, in that case, if, what is it? Indians and who's the other group that far in the movie? Cowboys,
yeah.
Right. So that's really, as a child, that's all I ever understood of Native American population. And I say that to say, it's a shame that I had to grow up to learn of this amazing group of people that, you know, I mean, you're a little bit younger than me. or much younger, I don't know. But so I know I didn't grow up with that in school, so I didn't know. And not having any real Native American people in my family made it difficult for me to even really understand what it would mean. Although I have to say, being an African American, people would say to me, because of my hair texture, you must have some Indian in you. That's how they call it. You're shaking your head. Yes. Talk to me about that.
You know, I just, first let me say, I didn't get any experience outside of, you know, the Indian and cowboy fight in school either. So I don't, like you say, I don't know what they're teaching now, but that was also what I was exposed to in school. And outside of that, and it being around, you know, this time, Thanksgiving time, that was it. So, you know, I think it's interesting That just generally we have these ways of stereotyping each other within certain, you know, cultural sectors that we have. And so it's one of those things where it's like, oh, you have the good hair, you have the long hair, you have the full hair, you have the thick hair, what, you know, whatever that case may be. And, you know, if I'm honest, when I look at, you know, like my grandmother, even my grandfather, my father, if he grows his hair out, my great aunts, and, you know, there was like 17 of them. And, you know, you look at them, you can see those features, but I don't think at the time I took it as a compliment, you know, that there must be some Indian in you. You know, it almost kind of felt like a, what's the word I'm looking for?
Or
you know, it felt like you were being picked on as opposed to, you know, someone giving you a compliment. And I'll tell you, for the longest, I, you know, had pride in my hair. I really did. And unfortunately, I end up having a medical condition and end up losing all of my hair, what, in 2006? And got a completely different appreciation for my hair and what it is that I honor. So I no longer, you know, even just random compliments of, you know, hair even not relating to what it may be perceived as, or if it looks like you have Indian, don't necessarily take those to heart as I did before.
Yeah, I totally understand the way people look at you and then try to value or devalue based on their assumptions of your identity.
Yeah.
And the theme of today or this month is race and the workplace. This is our actual third installment. And Professor Harper really informed the discussion or the topic because he shared with me that he could talk about self-identification, and that is like the best topic to talk about when we are talking about Native American heritage and our identities, because like you say, what is our identity based on our heritage, based on what we look like, or based on what we know? Like, if there is any Native American heritage in me, I don't know it. And it's totally a possibility, right? Because historically, Black people or from Africa when they were enslaved were also around Native American populations, and there's historical record of Native Americans having slaves, as you know, having African Americans or Africans then as slaves, so and being in connection with them, so there's certainly that, but doesn't necessarily mean that that was all that the relationship was about. There's, you know, something to be had where there's this large other that is taking land and devaluing your relationship with others and within your own tribe, so that you can't be equal of equal status with the major group. So that is obviously a binding way or something, a way both cultures could be bound. I don't know. I can't talk tonight. Well, that's good, because we have right now Professor Timothy L. Harper. Hello. Say a little bit about yourself that you'd like to add to the audience and share why you're here. And I know you have a word of wisdom you can also share with us, and I'd like to hear that too.
Okay. Well, hello, Kimberly. Hello, Summer. It's good to be here. As Summer suggested, I'm also very excited to be here this evening, and thank you for inviting me. And so what I thought, I just thought I'd go through some of the topics. So I guess my word of wisdom is actually in the form of a question that I've been wrestling with, not only with myself, but with my students as well. And that would be, do you, when you deal with people who are racist, when you deal with people who are sexist and all the other isms, right? Is it that the workplace, is it that the organization, is it the government should try to change that person? Or do you just remain happy changing their behavior? So let me just give you an example, right? So let's just say I'm a racist person and I'm your HR manager, right? Should the organization be satisfied with training me not to be racist in that role? or should the organization try to do even more by changing my racist attitude, for example? And so one of the things I'm wrestling with is whether or not how changeable are people, right? And it may be that we've been going down the wrong road trying to change people versus trying to get them to behave properly and ethically and morally in particular situations. So for example, I work for a company, and again, let's say I'm sexist, right? The idea is if that company can get me to behave in a way that's non-sexist for the time I'm at work, then maybe they have accomplished their goal. And maybe when I leave the workplace, that won't affect my behavior, my thoughts, my attitudes, my disposition. But at least for that 8, 9, 10 hours I'm at work, they've trained me and they've rewarded me and they've deterred me from acting in sexist ways. So thereby, the organization is better off. The people in the organization are better off. People who are coming to the organization are better off. So I think it's wrestling with what's the goal of a business? What's the goal of an organization when you house or when you host people who are racist or people who are sexist, right? And all the other isms. Is the goal to convert them? Is the goal to change them? Is the goal to manage them, right? And so I think I'm landing on the idea of managing people. That is to try to get them to behave in ways that are moral, behave in ways that are ethical, behave in ways that are upstanding while they're representing my company or while they're representing my organization. And I'm less concerned about when they leave the workplace, because I think that's when we get into trouble. And I'm not saying that, for example, we know that people do things outside of work that gets them in trouble at work. So I'm not saying that shouldn't happen. What I'm saying is I think sometimes business organizations try to extend their arms beyond the workplace, and they end up being disappointed at the lack of response from people who want to behave the way they want to behave.
I like your word of wisdom, because you flipped the script a little bit and it changed actually the order of the conversation. I want to, because usually I wait a little bit later to have this kind of group discussion. But I do want to, because I'll forget and it's important, and then I'm going to give you back the helm. I don't know, should I call you Professor Harper on air? Is that good?
Call me Tim is fine, please.
Tim is fine. Okay, I like Tim. Okay, so, and may I call you Summer?
Yes, you may.
Okay, so very good. Because Tim mentioned, identities and being ethical. And Summer, you do trademarking. And I don't know if this is about trademarking with brand, but you know, with the Native American population, some have decided that they didn't want to see the Redskins or have teams have the brand of a Native American. And recently, I didn't even know this, but I buy Land O'Lakes butter, and they took the Native American who sits in the middle of the brand Land O'Lakes butter out of the picture. And they did this to African-American products or African-American visuals on products like Aunt Jemima, and totally changed. So I don't know, so this is kind of like helping Tim with his word of wisdom. What would branding, like having that, what would that mean? Would that be an ethical change professionally, or would that be more of a social structure?
You know, Kimberly, I think it's both. I would like to think that, you know, if I were the owner of a business, that had a brand identifier that was culturally inappropriate, not in direct relation to my culture or business that I am representing, that it would be ethical to change. However, I do believe there is also socially, because I think now, especially with the advance that we are seeing in social media and online businesses, there's more of a push to be socially conscious within your business, and making sure that you are being culturally appropriate. It is a huge social issue right now. And so I think whether you think it's ethical or not to make the change from a branding perspective in your business, socially, you're going to be pushed to think that way. And, you know, a good example of that is there was a recent trademark issue where Walmart tried to trademark, like a Black Lives Matter or something, ice cream or something like that. And they filed a trademark for it. And as a community, the African-American community pushed back and they expressly withdrew their trademark shortly thereafter. So we as a people and as these different cultures, you have the ability to make change and to see change from a social perspective with some of these organizations and some of these businesses at this point. So I think it's both ethical and both social.
And that's coming from my trademark attorney. So back to you, Tim.
So you want me to finish? So I'll just sort of make some statements here. So first of all, I like to sort of do what I call demographic diversity. And what demographic diversity would be, would include all the protected classes from a federal perspective. And as we know, New York City and other cities have higher numbers of protected classes, large number of groups. And then I also like to do what I call sort of factors that are not protected, but they're often the factors upon which people discriminate against others. So that would include attractiveness, it would include height, it would include weight, it would include issues surrounding appearance, for example, tattoos and ear, you know, jewelry and those types of things. So I'd like to deal with both, because I think what happens is, and I think you have to deal with the historical protected classes, because we know generally that's where I would say significant discrimination and prejudice occurs. But I think more subliminal, right, and more subconscious tactics are used against people based on height, based on weight, based on attractiveness. So, for example, research shows consistently that there is a pro-attractiveness bias, right, on the part of interviewers. In other words, that if you are attractive, then you are rated higher as an interviewee, irrespective of the performance. Research shows that there is a anti-obesity weighting that goes on in an interview, so that if you are obese, you can have the same interview as someone who is thinner, but because you're obese, then you are rated lower, right? So I always like to deal with those issues as well, because I think those are issues that sometimes we don't address and we don't cover. And a significant number of people in the workplace fall in those categories where they might be hurt, are harmed by organizations and by people within organizations on those factors. So I try to make sure I talk about both what I call salient factors, those things that we can see, but also the non-salient factors, which I think are just as important in terms of looking at demographic diversity.
Now, as I'm listening to you and you're saying protected classes, I'm thinking, I possibly understand protected classes. You mean those that can file a court case if they have been discriminated? And right now, the protected classes would be all minority-considered people, BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, people of color.
Well, yes, yeah, it's usually based on categories. So it would be like race, ethnicity, age, national origin, language. So it's like nine categories, gender.
Oh.
So it's nine categories that would be listed on the federal level as protected classes. And then as you go to different cities and different states, so generally what you'll see is that what historically has been known as the more liberal cities and the more liberal states, they add categories that, for example, that are not added at the federal level because it's harder to get issues added at the federal level. And then if you go to a place like New York City, I think they have like 13 protected categories.
Wow, okay. Now, you were saying that you like to have a discussion about both. When you're talking about identification, do you think, well, people, like you said, attractiveness, it's the eye, you know, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? So you can learn how to do a great interview and wear the best clothes and smell great and just say all the right things. However, you're saying that if someone just sees that you're not attractive in their eyes, because it could be your skin color, your hair texture, your shape, the weight, your height, all of that stuff. You're saying it's what you want to talk about. But that is something, of course, that one can't change, and they can't decide to not identify that way, right? Because
right, but the problem is, again, no one identifies as not attractive. Even though there have been lawsuits, people have filed lawsuits saying that the reason why I didn't get this job is because, you know, the persons who interviewed for the job and were, the person who was hired was more attractive than I am. So there have been lawsuits about attractiveness, but in general. Right. It's one of those categories where, as you said, because beauty lies in the eye of the beholder, we're all attractive, right, to some degree. So you're not going to get a lot of lawsuits in that category. But I think the thing what we have to recognize, and this is one of the things that I like talking about, right, that attractive people generally know that they have an advantage. So they learn that socially over time. And so I'm not saying necessarily they manipulate situations, but because they've received compliments and because they've received reinforcement about their attractiveness, then that becomes an advantage. It becomes a privilege that they carry with them. And it's an unstated privilege, right? They're usually not walking around saying I'm attractive, but generally they know it. And then they also can see how people respond to them in interviews, for example, or even in an elevator pitch. And the way, one way to think about this is when you're on an elevator, right? I was like sort of using these examples. So I'll give you three quick examples. One is on an elevator, right? Whether or not when you step on an elevator, people, and this has to also do with race and appearance, right? When you step on an elevator, people move away from you or do they stay where they are? That has a lot to do with what we call salience, how you look and how you appear, right? Another example is when you're on a train and the train is full and people have their bags in their seat. Let me ask you, please, Summer or Kimberly, don't answer this. But who are you more likely to move your bag for, right? To let them sit next to you. That's about salient discrimination, right? And then the other one is on software. So if you've ever flown Southwest Airlines, you have A, Bs, and Cs. And so what happens in the C category is all the Cs basically have to sit in the middle. And so it's very interesting how people will sort of welcome people. So you have a person on the aisle, you have a person on the window, right? So they know that someone has to sit next to them. So they basically sit there and with their eyes, and they're giving these social cues about to people as they walk by, whether or not I want you to sit by me or whether I don't want you to sit by me. So it's basically nonverbal cues. But those are just three examples I like to use where people who might be deemed unattractive for any reason face those kind of consequences. And it tends to go unspoken, but I think it does a lot of harm to their psyche and to their emotions.
I can understand what you're saying because I was recently on the train. Summer and I met in person at the United States of America Women's Entrepreneurship Collective. Did I get that right? USAWEC, right? It's an organization that's designed to help women business owners grow and scale their businesses. In our case, it was a 5-month program, and we had lots of activities and assignments to complete in order to receive an invitation to the assembly. And we both were satisfied the program requirements, and we were invited there. And on the train, I said all that to say, I wanted to get that in, but I was on the train, and I usually like sitting where four people can sit facing each other. Because either way you're going, you can see, you have a good view. And I was there, and there were people that were on both sides, and they had bags. And I knew it was going to be a full train. They even warned us it was going to be a full train. So I knew I could literally sit anywhere because it's going to be a full train. We were leaving from New York City, coming upstate to New York, upstate New York, I mean. And they didn't move their bags when I came in. So I found a different seat. And then eventually they did move their bags. And I'm like, you know, it's like they didn't want me sitting there. And I'm not overweight. I'm not very tall or very large. And I don't believe I was very sweaty and smelly. So I don't know why. So they obviously didn't feel like I was, I'm going to put quotes there, attractive, because you can be attractive to some people and not attractive to others. So it's not being attractive in a general case.
Right.
It's maybe if I don't like you because you have brown skin, I don't want you to sit next to me. Or if you're too young, you might be too crazy. An older woman might not want a very young person to sit next to them. So, you know, we can discriminate in many different ways with, you know, with the word attractive.
You know, Kimberly, I have been one of those people that has left my bag in the seat, like on a full flight, shamedly so, and done nothing with attractiveness. It's just my hope that maybe there's actually one seat available and I can wait until the very end and nobody will sit beside me.
That might have been the case too, but I wanted to like share what I thought was Tim's point. So Tim, has that ever happened to you?
No, I mean, when you're in Southwest Airlines, it happens to you all the time. So what I do is I don't pay attention. So if I don't pay attention to nonverbal cues, and I'm just going to sit in a strategic place, whether you want me to sit there or not. And then I'm not afraid to ask you, will you please move your bag? So if Summer would have been on the train, I would say, Summer, can you please move your bag? I want a seat. So I just feel like you got to be assertive in those situations. And then going back to that whole idea, right, that whatever was bothering that person, first of all, you might be giving them an opportunity to learn something that they wouldn't have learned otherwise by sitting, you know, by you sitting there. And then the other thing is that because you paid for it, right, you deserve to sit there.
You know, I was going to say, I would have happily obliged, and then we probably would have had a great conversation for the rest of the flight.
So, you know, I think this is a good place for me to insert the segment DYK. Do you know? Because what we're talking about is that you really don't really know someone until we have that conversation next to them, right? And that's a great way of knowing. But I think people don't really know about, and I'm going to bring it back to Native Americans, the fact that they were service people in the wars that the United States of America and before it became America were in. And one of the things that they did was code talk. And code talk, I believe it was in World War II, which in order to make sure that the enemy didn't understand what was being shared via through the radio, they brought in Native Americans so that they can converse with each other in a language that can't be broken. You know, the code couldn't be broken because it's a real language, but nobody knew it. So they were able to talk to each other. And so that really helped us win the war. So, and I mentioned code talking, code talkers for them, because we do a lot of that to ameliorate people who we are with or around. We code switch. We would go from speaking the way we normally would at home with people that we are comfortable with, and language, and within maybe even change our language into a dialect, some people. And then they say, then you speak a different way and you actually have a certain cadence of talk. So you don't even just start speaking a different language, you literally start sounding like a different person, that if you were on the phone talking to your mom wouldn't even know it was you because you sound so differently. So code switching is something that you may decide to do with what you're talking about, trying to be attractive, you know, in a sense, trying to make people realize that you're part of this culture, of this professional culture. And each profession has that kind of code, right? When you're a police officer and you have, you know, breaker 1, 2, I don't know what they say, but and then in the legal field, of course, you guys have your codes, right? Summer. So we have a lot of code switching, but when you actually change the way you sound or the cadence of your voice, what is that all about in business? Is that something that you would say is necessary to be done to be attractive and to get hired or to get that raise? Dr. Tim. Tim?
Oh, okay, I thought Summer wanted to respond. Did you want to respond, Summer, first? So I think part of it is conformity, right? Social conformity. So I sort of differentiate between social conformity and attractiveness, right? So I think social conformity is when you basically play the game, right? You find out in your specific field or arena that here's what's acceptable and here's what's not acceptable, right? And generally, most arenas have a ladder, right? And you have to climb that ladder. And so usually at the beginning of the ladder, you have to do more conforming than not conforming. And then when you get to a certain point, you can become a nonconformist. But it's hard. I would say really only geniuses are able to be nonconformists when they first enter into a field, right? Because basically you got to play the game for it at some level, right? And so the whole idea is that when you conform, I guess, and this is the whole idea about identity, right? And whether or not you're betraying your identity or you're being a traitor or, you know, in some cases of African Americans, they might be called Uncle Toms or Aunt Janes and that kind of thing. So I think you have to make a decision about what your personal and professional goals are and then what's accepted in that particular field. And then you have to say, I'll just speak for myself. For me, I won't compromise my integrity or my values for my field. But that doesn't mean that I won't change my language. It doesn't mean I won't change the tone of my voice. It doesn't mean that I won't find words and use words that I would normally not use, but I'll use them, you know, in this arena. So I think for me, it's a matter of what I call the zone. So I have a zone of conformity that I'm clothing doesn't bother me. You know, wearing my hair a certain way. I'm not going to shave my mustache all the way off, you know, because, you know, that's what we do. So that kind of thing. So, but my integrity and my values, I would never compromise, no matter what arena I'm in.
Okay. In summer?
So what's interesting is I didn't realize that code switching was a thing until after, I guess you could say, I left working for other people. What's interesting for me personally is I grew up with being taught this is how you speak, this is how you sit, this is how you eat, this is how, you know, you're supposed to dress this way, you're supposed to carry yourself this way. I'm originally from Alabama, and those Southern, you know, traditions and rules were very much instilled within me. And so when I more specifically, you know, went to law school and started working for other people, I was doing what felt natural to me. It didn't feel like code switching. It just felt like, you know, I guess you could say turning on a different version of who I am, or, you know, as Tim said, going ahead and conforming to what was right for the situation, you know. Very much there's a time and place for everything. And at that time and place, that's who I had to be. What I realized is in my line of work, I don't like being so formal all the time. And a lot of my clients are entrepreneurs, they're small business, they're everyday people. And, you know, our code in the legal field would be, you know, what people call legalese. They don't understand legalese. So they like when I just speak plain English and give normal examples and, you know, break it down just how it is, which may not be acceptable, you know, at a top tier law firm, right? So I think it's for me less about code switching and just being comfortable with who I am, no matter what that looks like.
Well, yeah, I think you should. I mean, I think the term is just a term to be able to describe it, what we do. And I don't know if anyone saw, what is that show? Sanford and Son. And Sanford, he would have the police come over, and one of the police got, one would be black, one would be white, and the white guy would be, you know, police ease, and they would talk in the police language. And then Sanford would look to the black dude, and the black guy would be like, he would break it down like, okay, yeah, he was in jail. You know, he would say it in, you know, everyday language. So, yeah, so that would be code switching. But, yeah, it's a way of describing the fact that, yeah, it's better. Some, you know, you have your professional mannerisms, and then you come home and you leave your even got some people that are married, they would say it, leave your work, you know, leave that person at work. I don't want to deal with that person. I want to deal with a different person than what I married, right? So, yeah, interesting.
You know, Kimberly, I'll make this kind of point too. One of the things that I struggled with along the lines of professionalism was if I speak how I normally speak, and I'm talking like right now, how I would normally talk, does that make me less professional? If it's not buttoned up and I don't pronounce every T or every N or you know what I mean? And so for me, I chose that the answer was no. You know, just along the lines of Tim said, it didn't make me any less professional if I decide to wear my hair, you know, this way as opposed to down and straight, or if I chose to wear makeup or not, or, you know, heels and a briefcase as opposed to my laptop in a bag. So, and I think in my field, if I can candidly speak, it is very old, very traditional, and very white. I am none of those things, and most of my clients are not either.
And times are changing. I just want people to know, because they can't see you, that right now you have beautiful braids, long, beautiful braids, right? So when you talked about wearing your hair differently, they don't see what your hair looks like. So I want to be able to share that with them. Oh, God, this is such a great conversation. And we are running out of time. So before I get to the end, I want to make sure that we have an opportunity for each person to share how the audience, the listeners, can, you know, hear more about you or to utilize your services. And I mean, then we can jump back into other things. I just know that we're cutting off at 8, right? So we don't want to, I don't want to cut you off midstream. So who wants to share? Well, I know, Tim, you're at Skidmore College. Do you want them to take any business classes? Do you offer any courses outside of the tuition?
Well, no, I mean, I do consulting as well, as you know. So I'm tharper@skidmore.edu. But I think more importantly, you know, as you suggested earlier, education. So I'm here really just to educate and not necessarily add to my business profile. But having said that, I will say a couple more things, but I will, you know, don't want to take time away from Summer to profile her business. So I'll come back if we have time. Thank you.
Oh, we'll definitely have time. Summer?
I am Summer Burnley on Instagram, Facebook. I am at Burnley Law, B-U-R-N-L-E-Y. And my email box is always open as well. hello@burnleylaw.com.
And I like that. Hello. A lot of people are using hello as opposed to info. And I think I'd like to use you because you do trademarked, and we already talked about some of the things you're going to help me do is keep me out of jail. We won't be specific right here, but so I just wanted to make sure we get that in. And of course, I'm Kimberly Y. Irwin, and you can visit, I think, both Summer and I on Facebook, right? You're on Facebook, Summer? Right. And Tim, social media for you?
I try not to do social media. Our church is on social media. That's the New Jerusalem Home of the Saved Church. So our church is on social media. But I have no, I try not to do social media as I have gone on to greener pastures, as you might say.
Well, that's fine. So share what you were going to share, because we definitely have time to continue our roundtable.
So I just wanted to make sure you understand why we talk about demographic diversity and why we talk about social identity, and just talk about some implications for organizations. So one of those things is the selection system. So what research shows is that, for example, people are discriminated on resumes simply based on their name. So if your name has any ethnic cues at all, you tend to be discriminated against. In terms of interviews, introverts are discriminated against in interviews. In terms of hiring, the hiring process, that tends to be highly discriminatory, and then the promotion process as well. With regards to team assignments, people prefer to work with people who are like them. So that means a lot of times when people are selecting teams, when a leader is selecting teams, that people of certain groups are always left off those teams, which means that they don't get the same promotional opportunities and they don't get the same training that other individuals get, because some of those two people are never selected. Performance evaluation, reward systems, and then organizational culture. So when we talk about demographic diversity, when you talk about race talks, which is, I think, a powerful way to sort of describe the show, this has serious life implications for many people, and we have to, you know, take this work seriously.
I concur. I don't know what more to say to that. It's just something we're still living with in America, and not just America, the world, right? So I did want to share some highlights of the segments, and one is firsts. And we do have a Native American first, but I'm going to try to be, try to use my guests as guinea pigs. This is a little kind of a game. I'm going to tell you what the first is, and you're going to tell me what you think the year they became the first is. Uh-oh. I mean, you can be wrong. I mean, I'm going to keep it live. I never share with you everything I'm going to do.
I'll stay on mute and guess the year.
And now you can guess. Okay, so you should guess. Okay, this is Mary Peltola, a Yup'ik woman, was elected to the U.S. House of Representatives to represent Alaska, becoming the first person with documented Native Alaskan ancestry to serve in Congress. What year?
I'm going to say sometime during the 70s.
Okay, who's closer?
I was going to say in the 2000s.
2022. I mean, I always think of Alaska as being a home for Native populations. And just recently, they were talking about the pipeline, right? And how they didn't want the pipeline to be built because it's over their ancestral homes in Alaska. And I think maybe all that hoopla finally people decided in Alaska to vote for an Alaskan native. Who knew? Now you do because you're listening to Race Talks. Woohoo! You know what? I would have thought the 80s myself. I mean, I thought I remember hearing the first when I was at a certain age of voting, but 2022? But I didn't say the first in Congress. I said the first in, so that might have been it. Maybe the first in Congress is the 70s, Tim. Maybe you're right.
Yeah, and I would just base that on, my days of, history. But again, it was just a guess, unfortunate guess.
No, but I mean, like I said, you're probably right. I was being very specific with the Native, Alaskan Native. And the only thing I want to share right now as we have the last few minutes is kind of like what we all either stated or suggested, that we need to be true to ourselves, but still being open to other people. Like you said, Summer, you would have a great conversation with Tim if he made you move your bag. So instead of, and I'm not putting you down because, you know, we're all the same way, me too. I've done it before when I'm like, God, I could have all this space to myself. Yippee. But I've always found that whomever I sit next to, unless they're a little bit, it's a great time. Some of them have to ask me to be quiet because I'm conversing with them so much and I don't really want, I don't want to stop. But so I would say and this is our last segment, right act. Actively engage in being around people you normally wouldn't be. I mean, don't wait for them to make you move your bag, right? Try to find a way to engage. So I'm going to share that there are many, like I stated earlier in the show, opportunities to visit and to network and to partake of the cultural richness of Native American heritage and life in the U.S. And abroad. If you're in Canada, they have the same population there because it was one big mass, and we the Europeans came and broke it down a little bit further. So definitely engage, and if you're local, you can engage in other activities and events that you might be interested in. And I just want to share one with a future guest. So I asked her to share the information. There's going to be performances at the Hudson Area Library Community Room, which is on 51 North State Street, Hudson, New York. And it's just this week, Friday and Saturday. If you're available, you can watch the Transcending Linguistic Prejudice Through the Art of Dance with focus on the Latinx community of Hudson and grappling with linguistic prejudice. So this is a dance routine that shares with you linguistic prejudice. I cannot wait to see that. I'm going because I can't even imagine.